I thought I might share just a little bit with you folks about our trip to Sri Lanka. Again, Elmer and I had talked about it, and he said that he thought maybe some people in the village that probably been out in that area, and even some that weren't there, might be interested in hearing a little bit about Sri Lanka. And for those of you that don't know, I'm on the faculty at St. Olaf College in the athletic department, and I'm the defensive line coach in football, and I'm the head baseball coach. And I've been there for 17 years. I've been in coaching for 34 years. And I'm involved in a couple of organizations at the national level, one of which is the American Baseball Coaches Association. And happen to be on the executive committee of that board, of that organization. It's a pretty prestigious position. And from that, I happen to get on the clinic committee of the United States Baseball Federation. Now that's a sort of a parallel organization that has among its objectives is to spread baseball throughout the world. And so being on that committee, I made a trip earlier to Colombia in South America with five other coaches and gave clinics for 16 days. Hopefully I could be with a team sometime that might go overseas, because we are sending teams overseas too, especially to places like Korea and Japan, as well as Central America. But anyway, because of that association with the United States Baseball Federation, I approached them a year ago this January and told the powers to be that I had a sabbatical leave coming up for a half a year, and that if there would be some country that would be looking for a baseball coach to come and teach baseball, I'd be available. And I said, I'd prefer a third world country. And to show you how fate would have it, that Sri Lanka had just put in such a request. And the evolution of that story is such that one of their ministers in Sri Lanka, they have about 48 ministers, and really they're comparable to our cabinet members. And their minister of fisheries was in the United States, and he watched the Los Angeles Dodgers play baseball, and he came back to his country and was very fascinated by the game. And it has, you know, a few of the things that they have in cricket, not very much, but in Sri Lanka they play a game called Elle, spelled E-L-L-E, Elle. And because it's a poor country, they play it with a bamboo stick about 40 inches long, and they hit a shaved tennis ball that they throw underhanded, and then they run all the way around the bases, somewhat like the game of rounders, which was a predecessor to baseball. But anyway, he went back to our ambassador, John Reed, and said, what do we have to do to get baseball introduced? Well, Ambassador Reed wrote Bowie Kuhn, Commissioner of Baseball. He turned the letter over to the United States Baseball Federation, because that's the organization of coaches. And that letter was turned over to them about 2 weeks before our convention. So that's how it all happened. So they sent us to Sri Lanka. And for 6 weeks, I borrowed some money to take Nancy along. And we took off in the last week in August. And of course, going that far, we negotiated through our International Studies Department at St. Olaf, how could we go as cheaply as possible, and where else could we go? And we found out that we could go around the world, now get this, for the price of $1,685. Around the world. Can you believe that? And of course, my travel expenses were paid. And of course, once we got to Sri Lanka, they took care of all of our expenses. And we stopped for a week in London. And then when we left Sri Lanka, we stopped for 5 days in Hong Kong, and 3 days in Tokyo, and 3 days in Honolulu. So it was a great trip. And then we came back to the States, and of course came to Holton Village to wind down a little bit. But Sri Lanka, it's this little island right here. It's a little teardrop-shaped island just southeast of India. And if you look at this, you can see that we flew from Minneapolis to London and down, and then we flew this way back, so you can see you don't get the perspective on the map. But if you had a globe, I went in the I went in the library today, and you know that little transparent globe. You look at that sometime when you go through there, and if you can find Sri Lanka, it's on there, and it's almost directly across from the United States. So it's 11 and a half hours difference time-wise. So this was really a chance of a lifetime. Now, I want to tell you just a little bit about Sri Lanka. It's formerly was called Ceylon. And it was, we know it probably as the spice capital of the world. Marco Polo wrote, whenever he lived, he wrote that he called it Ceylon then, that it was a tropical island that had everything that you would look for in a tropical island. I paraphrase that, but that's about what he said. Beautiful beaches, lush mountain growth. But I want you to know this, it's a third world country. And when you look at the brochures, if you ever think of going to Sri Lanka from the travel agencies, you'll see the beautiful beaches and you'll see the hotels and you'll see the lush mountains, but you won't see the streets with their teeming hundreds walking, many of them barefooted, and probably eating a fraction of what we eat every day. And I'll tell you another thing, that if you go into a library and read about Sri Lanka in the encyclopedias or in those types of books, they'll tell you many things that are factual, but there are many things that are not there. I went in today and just happened to read through those things to see what it said. And then you'd get a kick out of this. In the Britannica, it's got all those things listed, you know, about three pages. And it said highways. They have a well-developed, extensive highway system. And you can't believe the roads. Well, there were many other things there that really were not true. They really were not true. Well, I want to go on, and I just outlined a few things here that I'd like to cover. Location of Sri Lanka, it's somewhere between 6 and 10 degrees north of the equator. So it's a tropical island. The temperature, all the while we were there, was somewhere between 80 and 92 degrees every day, and it was humid. The encyclopedia said the range is from 82 to 95, something like that. But it's hot and humid, and they have very, very few air conditioners. I wonder what percentage of the people have air conditioners. Well, many of them live in little typical Sri Lankan home. I wish I had some pictures. You know, we have a couple hundred pictures, but I didn't have the slides made up. But a typical dwelling place is a little shanty. They'll take the coconut palm trees and weave them. You people at Holden would have that'd be a great thing to do if we could get some coconut fronds up here. But they weave them and they make walls out of those, and then they pile them up on the top and make thatched roofs. And many of the walls too, they have what they call
you mean that daub stuff?
Yeah. What do
some
they call
kind of, well, they take the earth and mix it with water and chunk it together, and that's their walls.
They just cut little bamboo stakes and put them in the ground, and then and cross other ones, and then they just take mud, just take wet mud and just slap it around. And yeah, it's like adobe, but they call it mud dauber or something like that. I'm not sure what it's called, but they say when they get the monsoons, then of course they'll crumple oftentimes with the heavy rains. They do have two monsoon seasons. If this were Sri Lanka here, on the west coast that comes in October and into December. And on the east coast, it comes in March. Now, the rest of the time, it rains. I remember those people saying that they get anywhere from 50 to 200 inches, depending on where the island is. But they do have some areas, again over on this side of the mountains, where the rain is such that they have dry periods. And that's one of the things that they really struggle with, because their main crop that they eat, as we learned on our hunger awareness nights, is rice. And right now, Sri Lanka cannot raise enough rice to feed their own people. They're importing rice. But hopefully within the next decade, they're going to be able to solve that. But now, a little bit about about the, you know, the location? The size of Sri Lanka is about 250 miles, I think it is, from north to south. It's about 135 across. And it's shaped something like this, like a little, like a teardrop. And Colombo, the capital, is right down in that area. And Kandy, the beautiful city of Kandy, if you ever go there, that's really the, what would we say, Nan?
What's the highlight for the tourists?
Yeah, it's up in the mountains, and it's cool, about 75 degrees, and there's a lot of culture there. That's where the Buddhist temple of the tooth is located. Supposedly one of Buddha's teeth is inside of that temple makeup. And but that's about a 3-hour drive, and it's probably 75 miles, but it's a 3-hour drive, and that tells you about the highways. We were over in Ampara, over in the irrigation district here. That was about 120 miles from Colombo, and that was a 10-hour trip. Now, there were 48 switchbacks up over the mountain, so that took care of a lot of it. But there were many, many places on the road that, on the road where the driver would have to stop because the potholes were so deep that you wouldn't even want to move them except just crawling over them. Those are the good highways that the encyclopedia talks about. And the traffic on those roads, of course, they have buses and vans, and sometimes the buses couldn't make the switchbacks without backing up. And so you get behind those. That's partly the reason why it took us 10 hours to make that trip. Now, some other places that you might read about in the newspaper. Up here is Jaffna. Now, the northern tip is about 20 miles from India, and it's very shallow up there, about 20 miles from the south to the east tip of India. Jaffna is the area where they have trouble right now. A lot of terrorists up there. One of the world's greatest natural seaports, Trincomalee, is right here. They wouldn't let us go there because of the terrorist action up there. That was a British naval base a couple centuries probably. Whenever the British, I guess from their reign until they gave up their...
1800 and 1850.
Yeah. Batagaloa is another Tamil stronghold. We were very close to there. They wouldn't let us go there, but we had some of their schools came over and we had clinics here. This is a great tourist area here. Nungumbo, Colombo, Kalutra, all the way down to Galle. Now these are seaport, the beautiful beaches on the Indian Ocean. But there again, the wind action was such that nobody was swimming in the beaches. They wouldn't, because of the undertow. So we didn't swim in the beach, not once. We did get a nice motel and swam in the pool of the longest pool in Southeast Asia, but we didn't get in the ocean, not until we got to Waikiki. Now, a little bit on the history of Sri Lanka. I don't know, from the books that we read, I think there'd been people living there probably, a couple centuries before the modern civilization came. The people that are there now are categorized into about three groups mainly. There are the Sinhalese people that came from the books, the encyclopedia said northern India. The people there, the Sinhalese people, told us that their ancestors came from Pakistan. And the Sinhalese are mostly Buddhist, about 65% of the population. About 25% of them are Tamils, and they come from southern India. Now, many of them have been there for centuries. Now, some of them are still coming, and the ones that are coming, the government does not grant them citizenship. But you have the original Sinhalese that are Buddhist, and the Tamils that have been there for centuries from in southern India, they are Hindus. And then they're about 5% Christian, and many of them, of course, came from the early settlers from Europe, Portugal originally. And then there are about 5% Muslims that their ancestors came from someplace in the Arab world. So you have this conglomeration of people, and they have some political problems. I liken it very much to the Middle East problems of the Israelis and the Palestinians. The Sinhalese and the Tamils, some of them just hate each other. They detest each other. And the Sinhalese people, they live in fear that India is going to come down and invade them. They really do. Even though they control the situation in Sri Lanka, when they look to the north and see India, why, they're just a drop in the bucket, see. And some of the problems, we asked all kinds of people how those problems started, and they've been there for a long time. But anytime you have two groups of people and there's bad blood, they look for things probably to keep it that way. The Sinhalese people feel with 65% of the people that they should have 65% of the seats in parliament. And there are more Tamils than what their percentage should allow them, the quota system, so to speak. The Tamils are people that are intelligent, they're hardworking. There are more Tamils that get the university spots. They have a testing system in school, and the ones that test out the highest go to the university. And the Sinhalese people kind of resent that there are more Tamils that are getting into the university and ending up in professional positions. So you have that little bit of a feud. The Tamils, most of them are right now that are in the terrorist activities, live in the north, and they want that Jaffna district as a separate state. And of course, they're never going to get that. So you have this feud going on all along. In 1983, they had some terrible outbreaks that you may have recalled where it was just a planned affair. On one weekend, there were hundreds of Tamil businessmen that were just blown out. And you could see them walk down the streets of Colombo, Kalutra, Nagumbo, and you can see these corner buildings right in the business district that are just burned out. And people say, well, that was the riots of the summer of 1983. Our embassy people said that they couldn't have believed it, that these peace-loving people, and the Buddhists and the Hindus are, man, peace and tranquility and love, that's their way of life. But these calm people, they said, you couldn't believe. They saw them dumping gasoline on people and lighting them a fire. And their favorite trick was to stop cars, and if they had Tamils in them, the Sinhalese people would throw some kind of a chain around it and bolt the doors shut so they couldn't get out and dump gasoline on the car and light it a fire. And these are our loving people. All right, now then the Tamils, of course, retaliate, and now you have all these Tamils that are still getting revenge. And we were there almost every morning. You'd open up the paper and you'd read of some terrorist action. One day a bus had 15 people were murdered. One morning, the week before we left, they had a bomb go off in their fuel system, you know, the pipes, underground pipes. And they broke out the security people, and they found two other sites where they got the dynamite before it went off.
Yeah, that was in the Capitol.
Right near the Capitol, was it?
Well, in the Capitol.
Yeah. And innocent people were hurt. I don't know if they had any deaths from that, but it's like everything else, you always have the innocent people that are hurt. And I want you to say that the majority of the Tamils and the majority of the Sinhalese are trying to get peace, but you always have the minority that are continuing this problem. And it's really hurting the country, because there are many tourist attractions there, but their tourist business has gone down to nothing. And most of their tourists come from continental Europe, from Germany, and France, and a lot of people from England, of course, because it was part of the British Commonwealth up until 1948. Now, getting back to the history of the island, in about 1500, the Portuguese came in and conquered the island, everything but the highland area of Kandy. And the Portuguese ruled it for about 150 years. Then the Dutch came in, and they ruled for about 150 years. And the Dutch left, like all the Dutch places, they had canals throughout the island. And then the British came in at about 1800, because they had it for about 150 years. So there's been 450 years where they've had foreign countries ruling. And they were granted their independence in 1948. And they struggled within a political system until about 1972, when they've gone purely democratic, and they operate much like Great Britain or we do. They have many more departments within their cabinet system, within their parliament system. But they do have some problems, and probably always will. Now, some of the things that are interesting about Sri Lanka that might make it different from some of the other third world countries that have problems. At least we were told this from the people that we dealt with, and of course we stayed with many of the Sri Lankan people when we were out, that they said that the the spread between the rich and the poor is not very great in Sri Lanka. They have a lot of poor people. The majority of them are poor, but they don't have very many wealthy people. And they have some things built in. One of the things is that you can only own 50 acres of land in Sri Lanka. That's the maximum. And I understand in some of our Scandinavian countries that's true too. You have to work the land to own it. We did meet some people that by their standards were rich. They owned 50 acres of land. One fellow, a great friend of ours, that owns 50 acres of coconut plantation, and he also has some fishing industries. And he's a great fellow that said that he felt, because I'm a rich man, he said. I don't know what, by our standards, he probably wouldn't have been very rich. But he said, I feel obligated to share my wealth with other people. And he was a great leader in his church. He had a lot of programs that he was involved in the church, and he had a lot of, within his fishing industry, they have a lot of those little boats where they'll have three people running the boats. And he said that we operate strictly on a percentage basis. He said, I have three people on a boat. He said, we divide it, he said, equally. I own the boat, and those three people who work it, he said, we divide it up a fourth each. It's a two-man boat, they divide it that way. He said, that way, he said, they'll work harder and get more fish. He said, but he said, I know I could charge more. He said, I could get a bigger percentage. But he said, I don't feel that's right. He said, I want to share my wealth. But they don't have a lot of wealthy people. I don't think they have as much foreign control either. I know the British have some control over their tea plantations, but most of their plantations are run by the government. But frankly, I don't know what the solution is to their to their standard of living, because they talk about their literacy rate being 85%. I don't know if that literacy rate is the same as what we would consider. Their public school system, they go to school until they're 15 years old, and they can go all the way to the university free. Even in the parochial schools, the federal government pays the teacher salaries. That's kind of different. But then the parochial schools must allow non-parochial school or non-Christian kids in the school. An interesting story. I don't know if the Americans would do this, but down in Clutra, a very poor town, down in the rubber plantation area, down in the southern part. If this were Sri Lanka, it would be down in this area. We spent a week there with a Catholic school, very humble people, and I asked the brother that was the principal of the school. I said, I knew about the government subsidizing in the way of teacher salaries, and I said, do you have to allow non-Catholic kids here? He said, oh, yes, he said, 5% of our kids are Buddhist, he said. And I said, well, what, do you teach religion? He said, yes. I said, are all your teachers Catholic? Oh, no, he said, 5% of our teachers are Buddhist. He said, I wouldn't have to, he said, but I think that's no more than right. And he said, when we teach Catholicism, he said, our Buddhist teachers teach that religion. He said, that wouldn't be any more than right. And that's something. That's what he said. And we talked about the Buddhists, because we looked at some of their shrines, and he said, well, I don't know. He said, Coach, I don't know if that's much different than us. He said, you know, if you look at our rosaries, and if you look at our crosses, he said, they probably say, well, that's like we look at their shrines. Well, I don't want to dwell too much on this. A little bit about their resources. They raise tea and rubber. Those are probably their biggest exports. They mine a lot of gems, rubies and sapphires.
Semi-precious and precious. Yeah.
Oh, and the working conditions in those mines, you can't. We didn't get down in here and look, but we talked to people and we saw where they were working in those mines, and during that monsoon season, it hit about the time that we left. They have the fishing industry. They eat a lot of fish, but they really haven't explored that. They're trying to learn from the Japanese, I think, because the Japanese and the Russians fish those waters, of the Indian Ocean. But one of our friends who was the head of the Harbor Corporation, he explained how they're trying to really improve their fishing industry, and they're trying to learn from the Japanese, and hopefully that maybe they could even export fish in the next 20 years too. But that's You know, they're at the grassroots level, just like in baseball, they're at the grassroots level, I think, in probably in that area too. Some other things, they raise a lot of coconuts. Their beaches are just lined with coconut palms. But part of their problem is that they can't raise enough food to feed their own people. They have to import rice. Now, hopefully, I mentioned in the next decade that will end, because they have a number of rivers, and one of their large rivers, the largest one, the Mayawili, is that something that's something like that? I'm not.
Or Mayawila, I don't know.
Anyway, that river is about 130 miles long, and it's such that it comes down. If this were Sri Lanka, it comes down in this area, and in that area where they can't raise much because of the drought, they figure that once they get this irrigation system settled, that they can take some of those dry areas and also some of the jungle areas and raise rice. And they have just made tremendous strides in the last 10 years irrigating. We saw some dams that through the efforts of the United States and Germany and Sweden
and
Canada, they get a lot of foreign aid by the way of loans. And they have dammed up that river, and they right now are probably at the point where they can raise 90% of the rice. And when they finish this project, they hope to be able to export it. And what they do is kind of interesting. They'll take people and move them out. In fact, they flooded one whole community of about 20,000 people. And they moved them out prior to this flooding, and they give them about 2 acres of land and give them enough material to build their own homes. And so most of the rice growers are small operations like that with these little rice paddies. So that's their dream. And we stayed with some of those irrigation people, and a lot of them are working with our aid people, you know, the Agency for International Development people. And that's most of our foreign service people are working as consultants in those irrigation projects. I don't think the United States relationship with Sri Lanka has been good all the time, but I think right now it is, and probably because they realize that we're helping with that irrigation project, and I think they're also concerned about the invasion that, you know, that they're worried about from India, and I think they could get some support from us in that. Now let's see here. I kind of rambled here. Nan, you can help me out if you want to. Among the other things that we saw was that we were on, as we went over the countryside, we saw those vast tea plantations. They raise tea in the upland area, where the climate is cool on the mountain slopes. And they have vast rubber plantations. I don't know if you've ever seen rubber plantations, but they introduced the rubber trees from South America many years ago, and it's one of the world's biggest exporters of rubber. But of course, I raised a question, why couldn't you just get your fair share of the profit with the rubber? And we were told that it wouldn't work because you know, the other countries that import the rubber would find ways to get along without it. So they're kind of over the barrel, so to speak. Those rubber plantations, I asked what those people work for. They work for 25 rupees a day. That's the equivalent of a dollar. A dollar a day, 7 days a week. And they work hard. We watch those guys go out there and shave those little Sri Lankan guys. They weigh about 80 pounds, and they cut their little slit in the how many have you ever seen rubber trees? Isn't it interesting how they make that little slice, and then it runs down? It looks very much like Elmer's glue. It runs down, and they collect it. They have I wish I had those pictures. They have, you know the inner part of the coconut? You've all seen that. They just cut that right in half. Then they have that inner part. This is the half of a coconut. They just kind of stick that right underneath, and here comes the latex curling around the bark, and it goes in there so that it probably fills up a half a coconut shell, maybe a cup, maybe a half a cup. And then people come along and just dump that, set it on the ground, and they go all around and dump those, and then they carry those buckets of that latex. It looks like Elmer's glue, or more like a white rubber cement. And then after a little while, After a little while, that latex, it runs down, it starts to harden, just like rubber cement, and then it sticks right there. All right, so then that takes place, and then the next day they come along and they shave a fraction of an inch off, and then it runs down again. And so after X number of years, I've forgotten how many years, then the rubber tree will be cut down.
It's 80 years old when it's done.
And then
it starts producing when it's 20 years old.
But they have, you know, just like we do with our, some of our trees, they have small trees that they're growing and they replace them all along. And we were privileged to go into a rubber factory. And it's much like our cheese factory. They have a vat over there and they'll dump that latex in and add some chemicals and it coagulates. It's much like Play-Doh. And then they'll take it and they'll throw it into a lot of machines to kind of crush it and flatten it out and stretch it. And eventually it comes out in long sheets and they call it sole rubber. It's just like the rubber on these shoes. And it'll come in long, you know, probably 3 feet by 8 feet strips. And they hang it up to dry in a dark room so it doesn't bleach. And then they ship that all over the world. So that's what they, mostly that sole rubber. We had a long strip they gave us. We watched those people, a lot of women working in there. Water all over, standing in their bare feet. I thought, what working conditions? For a dollar a day. And that's about what the what the going wage is for any laborer. We saw people working on the roads. And you couldn't believe the working conditions. And I know that this is probably, their only salvation is that it creates a lot of jobs for them. But you don't find very much heavy equipment. The only heavy equipment that we saw on the roads was a roller, a small roller that you would see somebody working in your blacktop driveway. But they would, I couldn't believe this the first time we saw it. We were going along this road along the beach and alongside of the road, they were working on it, and here were women. And you see a lot of Sri Lankan, just like you do in other parts. I've never been to India, but my son has. And he said that you see people like this. Well, they do this to stretch, too, I know. Sometimes they just sit like this. Actually, with their feet flat, don't they, Ned?
Yeah.
Kind of like this. Mm-hmm. Well, you see these women sitting like this with a rock in front of them. And they have ball-peen hammers. And they're hitting like this. And then the little pieces of rock, other women will come along and pick them up with a metal saucer. It looks like a large frisbee. And they'll fill those up and then they'll carry them over and then they dump them on the road. And you'll have men kind of raking they'll chip out the old pieces of the blacktop and then they'll have a little sand and gravel in there and some of that hot tar that they'll heat up, 50-gallon barrels, they'll heat it up and peel the top off just like you would with a can opener. It looks pretty crude. And then these women come and dump the pebbles in there and they rake them out and then dump the blacktop on, put a little sand. Then the roller comes. That's the only heavy equipment. And that's the way they fix roads. And of course, I think, man, what if they had one of our road crews there, they could fix those roads in no time. But again, they wouldn't have jobs. So I suppose that's part of their problem. We came down that Kandy area once on that 10-mile trip, and we came around one of those curves.
10 hours,
what did I say?
10 hours,
yeah. We came around one of those bends, and you could look down, and there must have been 100 people, 100 men digging a trench right alongside of the road on the shoulder, right next to the mountain. And they were probably going to run some underground wires of some kind there. And they were about as far from marsh as to me, and each one of those men had one of those big, it's like a big wide grub hole. I don't know if you know what I mean. It's like an axe with an axe head with the blade turned the other way. And this is how they dig the hole, like this. And they flip it up like this. And about every 3 feet, there were men, and there must have been 100 men. And just all the way down the line. We came around the bend, and I couldn't believe it, because I would estimate there were 1,000 men around the bend. And they worked there probably all day long. And I said, you know, a guy with a backhoe could do that probably in one day. But they're out there working. So your heart goes out to those people. Probably work doing that kind of work. And they aren't very big. Well, those men are, most of them don't weigh much more than 100 pounds. They work hard and great loving people. Well, I'll stop there. Nan, why don't you just take a couple minutes and tell them about their dress.
The dress. Oh, well.
Both men and women. You don't have your batik outfit here, do you?
No. But the women wear the saris that you see in India. And one of the things that surprised us was someone, I forget who now, told us, you can't tell how poor these people are by the way they dress, because they all dress well. They make sure that their clothes are nice, even though they're poor. And if you go down the main streets of the big cities, why, if you look at the saris that the women are wearing, they're all different colors. It's just like splashes of color crayons all over the street, like those color boxes you get with two rows of colors. And those are the colors of their saris. And so you'll see kind of a soft green, and then you'll see a medium green, and you'll see a bright red, and you'll see an orange, and they're all this one color, but there's little patterns on them, so it's variety. But they have, I don't really know how they put it together exactly, but the Indian women that you see in the TV and so on, they kind of have a skirt that comes around, and somehow they have a scarf that's probably about this wide, and it comes across and over the shoulder, and then there's a big tail that hangs down the back. And some of the women have it draped a certain way, and some of them a little bit different, but it's all over one shoulder. Well, underneath this thing, this sort of blouse top, they all have a little bodice that they wear. And that's the same pattern, I'll swear, from Simplicity or something. But it stops right here, a little cuff, or a little, you know, no cuff, but just a plain sleeve. And then it kind of comes up a little bit of a cuff, and then it's just this neckline like this, and a tight bodice so that it stops here. And then this is bare. This is bare. So they get, I suppose, a little, you know, relief from the heat.
They're beautiful brown-skinned people. The men, most of the men wear, what do you call it? No?
I don't know, but you take a big piece of material, and it's all in one piece. It's like a big tube, if you were to stretch it out.
It's
and
a skirt.
You get into it, and then you take this side and this side, and you kind of loop them over.
Just wrap it around,
and
tuck it in.
Sometimes you can make a big knot here.
If it rains, they just roll it up so that it comes about knee high.
Yeah.
And then when it isn't raining, they drop it down so it's about halfway.
And they drive their bikes with these skirts on all the time. And
they gave me one. I wish I had that here. I'd model that thing. Oh, boy. It's that batik. You know what batik is? The beautiful cloth. And they do that very, very well. And Nan has a bunch of those. They were very generous with their gifts when we left, too much so. Because our best friend, this fellow that has a government position, and a government position, he has three jobs, really. He works with the Ministry of Fisheries. He's the number two man there, and he's the head of their harbor corporation, and he has another job, too. And he also is a volunteer as the president of their baseball federation, Eloy Fernando. There are a lot of Fernandos. That's back from the Portuguese days. But Eloy, they made the equivalent of $100 a month. And but he had a government car and expenses there. But we were at his house, and he had a duplex that was it was kind of a nice place. But he raised his family on the one side, then he had just a two-bedroom place on the other side. And then he moved into that, and now he rents his other place for equivalent of $300 a month to a Chinese couple that's there. So he makes three times on his rental of his property than he does on his salary. So their living conditions are quite different than what we're accustomed to. Well, I want to ramble through, just tell you a little bit about what we did.
It's getting late, though.
Yeah. Okay, about 5 minutes, and then we'll try to wrap it up. We were there 6 weeks. We covered part of the island and taught baseball to 17 schools. Some of them Catholic schools, some of them public schools. Most of them, there was a language barrier. In the good private schools, for example, St. Thomas College, and they call all their secondary schools colleges, but St. Thomas College was patterned after Eton, and those people could speak fluent English, and we could cover a lot more baseball there than we could at most other places where we had to have an interpreter, because Sinhala is their national language. And the people that we talked to said that was one of their downfalls. Back in, I think, in 1952, one of their prime ministers, because at that time the prime minister was the big power, they ruled that English would no longer be taught. And so they had one generation where they didn't teach English. And they realized that really hurt them. Because in their university system, many of their people that go on to graduate school and medical school and dental schools, they have to leave the country, and they go to Great Britain or to Germany or to the States, and then without being able to speak English, it really has hurt them. So now they're speaking English, they're teaching English in the schools, but in the private schools, that was not a problem. We were in some areas, over here in this Ampara area on the East Coast, we had Tamils and we had Sinhalese both, so we had to have double interpreters. Well, naturally it took a long while, but I taught more baseball by demonstration than I did by speaking. But wonderful people, just wonderful people. They opened up their homes to us. We stayed in their homes and ate their food, which was hot rice and curry. It was just rice and curry every meal. And they aren't very wealthy, so they gave us the best that they had. And you walk into a restaurant and they serve rice and curry, and they come with a platter about the size of the oblong plates that we have bread on. And there's enough rice there that you could feed probably eight people. And when we ate in the restaurant, the few meals that we ate there, they'd come with that much rice and a saucer right in the middle. So you'd scoop that saucer and you had all that rice left. And I don't know, I can't believe they'd throw that rice away. I'll bet you they'd serve it to the next party that came in. I don't know. But then they would come with the little plates, the little bowls, about five of them, with the curry. And the curry is a hot gravy, sort of like looks like pea soup.
It's brown gravy too, another part was white.
Most of it was green, if I recall. But anyway, they'd have fish in one, and they'd have beef in another, and chicken in another, and then vegetables in some, but it was all very hot. And we would ask for it to be tamed down. We would want it too hot, but it was awfully hot for us too. But they eat it really hot. The Sri Lankans say the good meal, it isn't a good meal unless the perspiration is dripping off your forehead. But we had some Sri Lankan meals that I thoroughly enjoyed too. And I think I like the hot food, but when you get it three times a day, it soon wore off. But the problem was we were eating some places with different people, different meals, and of course they provide the best that they have, and the best that they have is the same meal that you got with me with Bob. So it'd be like eating our meal tonight. If you eat that for, seven out of nine meals, I think we might not be too fond of it. But they were great people. One of the meals that I enjoyed was a breakfast they call egg hoppers, and I wish that I wish that we had some a pan where we could make that sometime. It was kind of like a round-bottomed, thick bowl. If you can imagine a small mixing bowl.
A griddle.
Yeah. And they heat that up real hot and put a little coconut oil just with a swab. They kind of line the inside of that and drop in some thin pancake dough. And then as soon as it hits, it kind of curls right up on the edges. And they drop an egg in there. And so the egg is frying inside of that thin pancake dough. Then they just tilt it and it slides right out. Then they take it and they roll it, and you can eat it just like a rolled pancake. And boy, that was really good. I think that's something that would go in America if we could do. That'd be a good thing. You start a restaurant, egg hoppers for breakfast. Well, I've covered a lot of things. We stayed with their people, so we were in their homes. We were chauffeured with a government car, which wasn't the best car. They don't have many good cars in Sri Lanka. They don't manufacture any of them there. Almost all their cars are Japanese made. We stayed in one guest house that the conditions were such that probably would have been condemned 100 years ago in the States. Conditions weren't the best. I was a little concerned for security. It had one light bulb, about 40 watts, and it was up about 12 feet in the air. So you couldn't read at night, and it gets dark at 6:30 there because it's right on the equator, you know. So we were fortunate there because the Catholic Brothers had us in their rectory for supper at night, and we'd sit and visit, and we'd get back about 9 o'clock, but then we'd have to go to bed because you couldn't read, and they didn't want to be out on the streets because we were the only white people there. I'm sure they wouldn't have been bothered, but you never know with some of those terrorists. So, and the one night we ate in the restaurant, and we kind of begged off, so we went to bed at about 7 o'clock that night, and we were awakened by the roosters and crows. I have to mention the crows. I was telling you about that the other day, Dale. The crows in Sri Lanka, if you can imagine in the fall of the year when our blackbirds congregate, our starlings and our grackles congregate before they go south, that's the way it is in their cities, only they're crows. They're just all over. And they will fly in through open windows and right in the buildings, and somebody will throw food on the street and they just fly after it and grab it and go. And the crows are their scavengers, because their disposal system isn't very good. Now they have running water, but the water isn't good to drink. You have to boil the water. They have a sewage system in cities, at least where we stayed, but they don't have always indoor plumbing. Some of the places, brother in Ampara, they put us up in a, they didn't want us to stay with people because he was embarrassed. They didn't have enough people in the community. I found out later where they had the sit-down toilets. They had the squatters. And then they just throw water. It's a hole that goes right down into their sewage system. He didn't want the Americans, right? That didn't bother us, you know. Well, they put us in the YMCA. And these are poor people. And we got out there. He didn't know Nancy was coming. So you know what they had in the back of the, in their YMCA, I tell you what, you people from the country, it was like the one of those buildings at the county fair. they had, if you can imagine the walls here, if you can imagine that every other board would be replaced. So it was just air, and the crows would come right in there. And then they had a couple of rooms in the back where the YMCA director had his office, and right next to that was a storeroom that they had made into a place for us to sleep. And we were thankful when we left there, but it was hard to sleep because the bed was about 5.5 feet long. They had the mosquito netting over it. We had to go out and down a couple of steps, and the toilet was it was a flush commode. But it was just, you know, the roof was like this, the mosquitoes flying around, lizards all over. They have lots of lizards in front. They eat the mosquitoes. But they, you know what those people did? They put a shower in there for us, just for us. The only problem was that there wasn't enough water pressure to get the water up there. So then...
You got your hair shampooed halfway.
Halfway. That's that one day. Well, then, you'll get a kick out of this. They had a metal tank, just like the stock tanks, you know, where the cows drink out of. And that was in the corner of the... And this is, I think this is probably par for the course there. They let the water run, and that's filled with water, about 3 feet of water. So that's how we would shower, you know, 85 to 90 degrees and teaching baseball for about 6 hours. It'd be hoarse and just sticky. And we'd go in there, and of course, just like a couple of sticky old birds, you know, we'd strip down and we'd take a bucket of water and we'd throw on each other, and then we'd soap up and then we'd just throw it, rinse it off. And that was kind of fun as we look back on it, wasn't it? But this guy, I want to tell you about this fellow. This fellow was one of the most committed Christians I'd ever met, this YMCA director. They put us up. He had arranged for the people to feed us. We went around town and ate every meal with a different person. And they had a big celebration when we left. They got a banner. I'm going to put it in my office at St. Olaf. It's about an 8-foot banner. He had that commercially painted. You know, welcome Jim Dimmick to the first, whatever it was, Ampara baseball clinic, something like that. And they had a big hoop-de-doo. And I realized one of the things he was trying to do was to get some of the people that were supporting the YMCA to give more money so he could get the projects going.
Yeah, he had all their names on the banner, too.
And some of them American people in the irrigation program. But here was a man that worked. He was 47 years old. He was single. Handsome guy. I don't see how he could stay single that long. But one of the reasons is he doesn't have a salary. He works for room and board and transportation. And now the YMCA is not like ours. You know, they have this little building where they have their meetings. This man told me that they have a lot of poor people in Ampara, and he said, I've had chances to go to Colombo, but he said, I think these people need me. Now, they have a project right now, what he calls his poultry project. They're building a little shanty. They're going to raise, he's going to teach those young kids how to grow, raise chickens and so they can supply their own eggs. They hope to have a little, about 5 rooms. They got the foundations laid for hostels where they can rent a room to people that come to town. He teaches those kids English at night, typing, and Bible studies, all of that, no charge. And,
He's got a staff and windows and doors ready for the rooms, once the rooms are ready, but he waits for money before he starts something.
Well, I could go on and on and talk about people like that. I kept the journal, and I think I'm gonna take about 1 minute and just read just a couple of comments in there. And what I tried to do was keep track of where we were and what happened, but just about two things that I wanna mention, if I can here. That brings out, I guess, my feeling towards these people. And maybe I can just read one, because I know it's getting late here. Thoughts on the haves and the have-nots. And my writing is terrible, so I'll probably have to decipher it. I kept a log on what we did, but then I tried to put some thoughts down too. I had thoughts on haves and have-nots. On Wednesday, we took a boat ride down a murky river into a lagoon, and finally an old Dutch canal into the gumboat. At every turn, we saw little kids, some naked, some with scanty clothes, some swimming, some running, all smiling, and all saying, hello. That's it, hello, hello, they'd say. I thought, how limited is their existence? Perhaps some have never traveled beyond a 1 mile radius, if that. Yet, they are so happy and contented. One wonders that by some quirk of fate, there could be one of our kids, rather than these little Far Eastern urchins. After our buffet that evening, big buffet supper in this swanky hotel where they put us up. See, after we went through that ordeal in the rundown place, one of their cabinet members who were in his electorate, so they put us up in this big, beautiful hotel, or motel, right on the Indian Ocean. After that buffet this evening, I commented to the four Brits that we were on the boat ride with that we probably consumed more protein that night than some of those kids on the river will consume in a year. The haves and the have-nots. It really isn't fair. Yet somehow, their happenings betray the security we have in our system, something like that. My writing is terrible. For they probably will never get caught up in our ego trips, etc. They seem to live each day in their little circles and let the rest of the world go by. Perhaps they are the real haves. Lord, help me to appreciate and tolerate the ways of others and not think that ours is always the best. Maybe that's not enough. I found myself writing stuff like that most every day. And my heart goes out to them. And boy, they're just beautiful people. And they treated us so wonderfully. They want us to come back sometime. And I don't know, I told my wife that it was an experience that it was a great experience, but it's one that I wouldn't care to go back to right away. And our recommendation to our ambassador was that if we could get a couple of Peace Corps volunteers out there to follow up what we started, that would be our number one recommendation. He thought that was a good idea. But of course, the Sri Lankans have to request the Peace Corps people. If that doesn't come about, my number two recommendation was to have a couple of coaches maybe go out and follow up in a year or two, because we just scratched the surface. But they're all enthused about baseball, and they couldn't do enough for us. Some of the gifts that they gave us, you can't believe. You can't believe. I mean, beautiful things. And I know they didn't have enough money to do it. So I guess I would like to feel that we were kind of ambassadors for our country. And I don't know, any questions you might want to have? I just kind of rambled here. If I had slides, I think it would really, if you could see some of the living conditions, you'd understand. You can imagine.
How many in a family?
Pardon?
How many average in a family get children approved?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of those countries, they talk about the population explosion, and it is there. But the families that we knew, a lot of them had two and three. But then there were a lot of those families that we saw on the river that there were five and six too. But I couldn't answer that, what the average was. And I don't think that they have the problem with the multinational corporations that are present in South America. I know when I was in Columbia, that's part of their problem. But here, outside of the British-owned tea industries, I don't think they have too much of a problem there. But
did the adults seem like happy people too?
Oh yes, yes, very much so. The ones that we knew, and even those on the street, you just see a typical street scene would be just literally hundreds of people. If you can imagine the street right out here, if you can imagine that street with traffic going both ways, no center line, and then you might be anywhere from 2 to 5 people walking abreast on either side, going both ways, bicycles, ox carts, a lot of ox carts on the road, people pushing carts while the traffic comes to a standstill. And every once in a while, one of those big old belching buses will pull right out in your lane, come right at you. Your choice is to pull over and stop or get hit. So that's the traffic. I guess that's the one thing that I couldn't get used to. And of course, our driver would just pull over and stop, let the bus go by, put it in gear, drive off. And if that had been me, you know, I'd have been shaking my fist at that driver and yelling at him. But that guy probably will live to be 70 years old and won't have ulcers either. Well, the hour is late. I'll be around for a couple of days if some of you want to ask some other questions. And I apologize for not having slides. It would have made it a lot more interesting. But if any of you ever get to go there, well, I do a lot of reading. We did that, and so we knew a lot about the island before we got there. And I surely know a lot more now. Good. Thank you.